I'll go ahead and get started while they're getting things set up here. I have a story to tell you today, actually to follow through in the Bible, the history of a particular family. Sadly, division within families is a common thing in human existence, and we find that the history of the Bible is not any different. It actually began very early. If you remember, the very first human family, there was a murder in the family. Cain killed Abel, and that had to be a very grievous thing for Eve to watch, and must have carried that through the rest of her life. But family division has been common for humanity, cut off from God ever since. Today, nearly 6,000 years later, we find that we still have families torn apart, divided, sometimes by real wrongs, sometimes by imagined wrongs, sometimes by misunderstandings, sometimes by misbehavior. We have to realize that's a part of it too sometimes, that drives a wedge between family members. It's sad to see, no matter what the causes or what the reasons may be. And sometimes it even affects families and the church members, despite their best efforts to heal breaches in families. Sometimes members are unable to heal those breaches. We recognize that you can't force anyone else to do something. We can do our best, but still not force someone in some situations. You may just simply have to let it be. Paul made a statement that I have repeated many, many times in my ministry in Romans chapter 12. Let's turn and read this. People that I've counseled who've had difficulties within families or difficulties with others within the church, relationship problems. Ultimately, we have to recognize God recorded Paul's statement in Romans chapter 12 as something that we have to always keep in mind. Romans chapter 12 and verse 18, it says, if it is possible, now that provisional word if means that it may not be possible, right? If it is possible, as much as depends on you, there's the other clause, all right, here's the point. Maybe it can work, maybe it won't, but as much as depends on you, you do your part. If it is possible, as much as depends on you, live peaceably with all men. It is a truism of life that you cannot control another person's mind. You cannot control another person's attitude. You cannot control another person's behavior toward you. But as much as lies within us, we need to do our part. But you can't force someone to be at peace with you. I want to talk today about a very prominent biblical family. I want to show how divided it's become. And I hope that at the end of this, it will help you understand a little bit about this family, and that it will help us, because we'll see certain things are going to come about in the end time related to this family. Understanding the division within this family explains the reason for some of the headlines we see today and some of the headlines we're going to see in the future. The family I want to talk to you about is none other than the family of the faithful, father of the faithful, Abraham. Abraham is listed as the father of the faithful. Abraham had it said of him by God, I know this man. I know he will teach his children and his children's children after him. So how did this family get so divided when it started out so good? I think that's something all of us need to keep in mind as we explore this today. How did these two parts of this family get into the position they're in? The family of Abraham is quite divided these days. Let's see if our little remote works. There we go. It really gives us the seeds, laid the seeds for a lot of family division today. The Israeli Arab cauldron of conflict continues to today, and it will continue. And it really comes from this family that has become split. The current civil war in Syria is an interesting example of the fighting even within different segments of that family. In fact, if you look at what's going on in Syria, it's two branches of Muslim who are fighting each other. You get two parts of the same group, Sunnis and Shias who were fighting against each other. But the one thing they agree on is if there's any ultimate enemy, it's that family that came through Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. It's that family of Israel. It's those Jews. Those are the real enemies. So if these ever quit fighting, they'll fight the Jews. It's always the ultimate goal is to get rid of the Jews, get rid of the nation of Israel. Really amazing to see that happen. In Genesis chapter 12, of course, we pick up the story of God calling Abraham. Let's go ahead and go to that chapter. Genesis chapter 12. The Lord had said to Abram, his name was Abram, of course, at this point, had not yet been changed to Abraham. The Lord had said to Abram, get out of your country, from your family, and from your father's house to a land I will show you. Verse 2 of Genesis 12, and I will make you a great nation. I will bless you, and I will make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Now, we've written a lot about this segment, so I'm not going to go into a lot of detail over it, but we recognize there are two aspects of this. Physical blessings, and then there's also this spiritual blessing, that through you, through your lineage, is going to come the Savior of all mankind. All families of the earth will be blessed. So we're told Abram departed as the Lord had spoken to him, and Lot went with him, and Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. Then Abram took Sarai his wife, and Lot his brother's son, and all their possessions that they had gathered, and all the and the people whom they had acquired in Haran, and they departed to go to the land of Canaan. So they came to the land of Canaan. And we have Abram, and we have his wife Sarai. This is the beginning. God promised he would become a great nation, even though they were childless, even though he was 75, even though Sarai was rather old at the time. Now we skip forward to chapter 15. I'm going to have to jump through a lot of this rather quickly. In chapter 15, the first few verses, it says, "In these things, after these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision, saying, 'Do not be afraid, Abram. I'm your shield, your exceedingly great reward.' But Abram said, 'Lord God, what will you give me, seeing I go childless? I mean, you said I was going to be a great nation, and I'm childless. I still don't have a child. And look, even the heir of my whole estate is going to be Eliezer of Damascus, someone born in my household, not my own son.' And Abram said, 'Look, you've given me no offspring. Indeed, one born in my house is my heir.' And behold, the word of the Lord came to him." Can you imagine what inflection there was in that? "I've waited these years. Nothing's happened, God. Where are you?" Abram was a little concerned at this point, I think, we would say. "And behold, the word of the Lord came to him, saying, 'This one shall not be your heir, but one who will come from your own body shall be your heir.'" Okay, so he's refining it a little bit. Now, it's not just somebody in your household. It's someone that comes from you, Abram, from your own body. He will be the heir. "And he brought him outside and said, 'Look up to the heavens, count the stars. If you can count them, that's how many your descendants will be.'" So here we have a promise of a great number of descendants. In the next chapter, we come to one of the roots of the problems of that family. Chapter 16, Sarai, verse 1, Abram's wife, had borne him no children. She had an Egyptian maidservant whose name was Hagar. So Sarai said to Abram, "See now, the Lord has restrained me from bearing children. Please go into my maid. Perhaps I will obtain children by her." And Abram said, no, not going to do that. I know that leads to trouble." No, he didn't say that, did he? Unfortunately, Abram didn't cut it off right there and say, no, we're not doing that. We're waiting on God. He didn't do it. He listened to her. My question is, how many times did Sarai talk to Abram to do that? Was it one time? 5 times? 10 times? 100 times? I don't know. And I guess it's not important to the story or God would tell us, right? But for whatever reason, Abram said, okay, all right. And Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar, her maid, the Egyptian, gave her to her husband, Abram, to be his wife. So this was a marriage. He married her. And it says, after Abram had dwelt 10 years in the land of Canaan. So he's what, 75 to 10 years, 85? He's 85 at this point. 10 years had gone by, no child. Sarai comes up with a way maybe to have a surrogate. And Abram says, okay. So he went into Hagar, and she conceived. And when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress became despised in her eyes. Oh, there was conflict. There was trouble. Now I'm able to have children. You can't. Problem's not Abram. Guess what? It's you. And there was conflict between the two of them. And it caused a lot of strife. Hagar despised Sarai, and Sarai was upset that she was being disrespected so badly by Hagar, and she sent her away. Hagar ran away. Sarai said to Abram, "My wrong be on you. I gave you my maid into your embrace, and when she saw that she conceived, I became despised in her eyes. The Lord judge between you and me." Well, now, wait a minute. This was your idea, Sarai. You're the one that brought it up, weren't you? And yet she's so distressed over this. And Abram said to Sarai, "Look, your maid is in your hand. Do as you please." And when Sarai dealt harshly with her, she fled from her presence. Now, I'm not going to read through the rest of the story, but God appeared to her. An angel appeared to Hagar as she was running away. Promised her that she would have a son. His name was going to be Ishmael. Verses 11 and 12 talk about that. He'll be a wild man. And it's interesting to note some of the comments that you read about this statement about his name being a wild man, his hand against every man, every man's hand against him. That description seems to fit some of the descendants of Ishmael, the Arabs who have taken their name from the area where they went, the area of Arabia, the area between the Red Sea and the Persian Gulf. They've fiercely defied being ruled over by others. And Hagar returned. And we're told Abram was 86 years old when Ishmael was born. That's in verse 16, the very last verse of this chapter. So, Ishmael was born, and verse 1 of chapter 17, when Abram was 99 years old. So, from 85 now to 99. So, another long time goes by, and God appears to him. And if we skip down to verse 15, it says, "Then God said to Abram, 'As for Sarai, your wife, you shall not call her name Sarai, but Sarah shall be her name. I will bless her and also give you a son by her. Then I will bless her, and she shall be a mother of nations. Kings of people shall come from her.' Abraham fell on his face and laughed, and he said in his heart, 'Shall a child be born to a man who is 100 years old? I mean, I'm 99 now. By the time that child's born, I'll be 100. And shall Sarah, who is 90 years old, bear a child?' And Abraham said to God, 'Oh, that Ishmael might live before you. I mean, he is my son. He came from my body. He's my son. Can't he be the heir?' And God said, 'No, Sarah, your wife, shall bear you a son, and you'll call his name Isaac. I will establish my covenant with him for an everlasting covenant, and with his descendants after him. And as for Ishmael, I've heard you. Behold, I've blessed him. We'll make him fruitful. We'll multiply him exceedingly, and he'll beget 12 princes. And I'll make him a great nation, but my covenant I will establish with Isaac, whom Sarah will bear to you at this seventh time next year.'" So Ishmael was to become great, but it wasn't through Ishmael that the promises were going to go. The promises were going to go through the other line, through Sarai. It was through her son that God said the blessings are going to go, through Isaac. And so you have these two divisions, these two segments, these two legs of the family of Abraham, and they're in conflict with one another. Now, I'll mention that Islam says the Jewish scriptures are in error, that it was not Ishmael who was the son of promise. I'm sorry, it was not Isaac who was the son of promise, it was Ishmael. I was looking up some things on some writings from different people had written from the Quran, and they said they are very specific that it was Ishmael. It's Ishmael who was the firstborn. It was Ishmael who should therefore receive the promises. It is Ishmael who is the son of promise. He's the one that God promised all these great things to. And the Hebrew scriptures are simply falsified. They've changed the name Ishmael to Isaac all the way through. So that's their approach to it. Now we find that we have all this conflict then between them, and trouble grows in the family. Turn to chapter 21 with me. Chapter 21, we'll pick it up in verse 8. After Isaac was born, in verse 8, It says, so the child grew and was weaned, and Abraham made a great feast, his name had been changed by now, on the same day that Isaac was weaned. And Sarah saw the son of Hagar the Egyptian, whom she had borne to Abraham, scoffing. And therefore she said to Abraham, cast out this bondwoman or her son, for the son of this bondwoman will not be heir with my son, namely with Isaac. And the matter greatly displeasing in Abraham's sight because of his son. Again, the friction between the two mothers, the conflict between the two children. And there's conflict in Abraham's mind as well. Abraham, it's displeasing to him. He really doesn't want to have to send his firstborn son away. But God says, don't worry about it. Go ahead and do it. Go ahead and do it. And we skip down to, we see that Hagar went into the wilderness. She thought she was going to die. God appeared to her. Or angel appeared to her, miraculously provided water for her and Ishmael. Verse 18, she's told, arise, lift up the lad, hold him in your hand, I will make of him a great nation. And the Lord opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water, and she went and filled the skin with water and gave the lad a drink. And so look, God was with the lad, and he grew and dwelt in the wilderness and became an archer. He dwelt in the wilderness of Paran. And his mother took a wife for him from the land of Egypt. And so he grew in that semi-arid area of the Negev, between the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aqaba. And again, just so you know, it was this area, the area of Paran, that Israel first went to after leaving Egypt. Now, Genesis chapter 25, I've already put on the slide one of the descendants of Ishmael. Genesis chapter 25 gives a listing of some genealogies. And in verse 12, it says, now this is the genealogy of Ishmael, Abraham's son, whom Hagar the Egyptian, Sarah's maidservant, bore to Abraham. And these are the names of the sons of Ishmael by their names according to their generations. Firstborn of Ishmael, and it mentions Nebajoth, and then it mentions Kedar. Now, Kedar is one that I put here up here on the slide because Kedar is the ancestor of Muhammad. The Islamic religion bases its heritage, goes all the way back to what they say is a prophet, Muhammad, and they take it all the way back to Kedar. Now, Muhammad lived in the 60s, AD 600s, rather. Kedar is sometimes used in the Bible as a collective name for the Arabs. You can read it in several different passages. You'll find it in several areas. Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel all wrote about the glory of the princes of Kedar. You can look that up if you wish. But these are Ishmaelites, or Arabs. They are descendants of Ishmael. Now, Ishmael also had a daughter. We'll see how she comes into that a little bit later. I think it may even be mentioned here. I didn't go back and look through this particular passage, but he did have a daughter as well. We'll see how she fits into the family. But Mahalath, I believe is the way her, or Mahalath, however her name is pronounced, we'll see that she fits into this picture as well. You might think the rift between Ishmael and Isaac would be enough within that family for them to have family friction because of those two children, but that was not all the case. You might remember Rebekah, Isaac's wife, that she was not able to have children for 20 years after her marriage to Isaac. That family had difficulty, didn't they? Having children, it seems. So she didn't have children. And again, she finally is blessed with twins, Esau and Jacob. And guess what? There's conflict between those two sons. We find that story as a part of the rift as well. Go to Genesis chapter 25 here in verse 23. As it talks about Isaac and his wife Rebekah having their twins. In verse 23, this is Rebekah speaking, or Rebekah being responded to by God. The Lord said to her, two nations are in your womb. Two peoples shall be separated from your body. One people shall be stronger than the other. And the older shall serve the younger. So again, we have this reversal of roles. The firstborn, Ishmael, doesn't get the promises. It goes to Isaac. So the firstborn, you would think, of her two children would get the birthright. But God says, no, the older is going to serve the younger. It's not the way things normally went. Esau was a hunter. We know that, says the Bible tells us, he was loved by Isaac. Isaac loved the food, the wild game that Esau would cook and bring for him. And Jacob was a mild man, apparently. He was loved by Rebekah. What's wrong with this picture? We've got favorites in the family, don't we? We certainly saw the conflict between Isaac and Ishmael, that there were favorites in terms of, this is my son. This is my son. This is the one God said is going to have the promises, not the son of that handmaid. So we have favoritism there. Now, in Isaac's family, we have favoritism. We have favoritism, one loving one son, one loving the other son. Not a good thing. Not a good thing. Sometime later, Esau was having a bad day hunting, asked Jacob for some food. Skip down to verse 30. A lot of this is condensed, but verse 30. Esau said to Jacob, please feed me with that same red stew, for I'm weary. Therefore, his name is called Edom. But Jacob said, sell me your birthright as of this day. There's a devious Jacob figuring out a way to get what God already said he was going to have. I mean, did he have to be deceptive about it? No. But he was. So, well, you're hungry? Okay. Sell me your birthright. And Esau, for his part, didn't think so much of the birthright, did he? Oh, I'm about to die. I'm so hungry. Okay, I'll sell it to you. Didn't seem to be much worth much, did it? Verse 33, Jacob said, swear to me this day. So he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. And Jacob gave Esau bread and stew of lentils. He ate and drank and rose and went his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. So we learn here that Esau despised his birthright, sold it for a meal. His name is Edom, which means red. And again, you know more of the story, how Rebekah got Jacob to trick Isaac into giving him the blessing also, instead of giving that to Esau. When Esau realized it, Esau asked for a blessing also. And when Esau asked for the blessing, that's down in verses 39 and 41. So we have conflict going on now in the family between these two sons. Verse 39 of chapter 27, Genesis 27, verse 39. Then Isaac his father answered him and said, behold, your dwelling shall be with the fatness of the earth and the dew of heaven from above, but by your sword you will live. This is the only blessing I can give you. I can't give you the first right blessing because I've already given it to your brother. But you'll also be blessed. However, verse 40, by your sword you shall live. Does that seem to fit the Arab nations? Live by the sword? And you shall serve your brother, and it shall come to pass when you become restless that you will break his yoke from your neck. And so Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing with which his father had blessed him. And Esau said in his heart, the days of mourning for my father are at hand. When the old man kicks off, I'll kill him. Literally, it's what he's saying. You know, days of mourning are at hand, and then I'll kill my brother Jacob. So talk about conflict within families. I mean, we're going back to the first family, aren't we, of Adam and Eve. Pretty graphic description of the continual hatred and the bitterness between the brothers and their descendants. Now, Rebekah heard that Esau was going to kill him, going to kill Jacob, so she devised a plan to get Jacob out of harm's way by sending him on to Laban on a wife hunting trip. Look, I don't want him to marry these girls of a different religion who are in the nation or nations around us. Send him off to our family. Let him get a wife from someone of our family. And so she got him out of there and got him to go to the family of Laban. There's one more piece of the puzzle to put in place at this time, the connection that allied Esau and Ishmael together against Jacob. This is in Genesis chapter 28, verses 8 and 9. In fact, let's pick it up in verse 6. It says, and Esau saw that Isaac had blessed Jacob and sent him away to Paddan Aram, to take him for himself a wife from there, and that he had blessed him, that as he blessed him, he gave him a charge, saying, you shall not take a wife from the daughters of Canaan, and that Jacob had obeyed his father and his mother and had gone to Paddan Aram. Also, Esau saw that the daughters of Canaan did not please his father Isaac, so Esau went to Ishmael and took Mahalath, the daughter of Ishmael, Abraham's son, the sister of Nebajoth, to be his wife in addition to the wives that he had. So we find that Esau says, okay, mom and dad don't like me marrying all of these women in the land, so I'll just take someone who is of the family. So he married Mahalath. So that unites the Arabs and descendants of Ishmael against Jacob. So now it's not just Esau and Jacob, now it's Ishmael and Isaac, Ishmael and Esau against Jacob. So another twist in this family tree. Very, very sad thing to see. He marries not because of love, but he marries for expediency. How does that work out? Well, I don't know about back then, but these days it seems that it doesn't work so well. So we have the Edomites and the Arabs joined together fighting against Jacob on the other side of the family tree. Now, I don't have time to go through all of the rest of the book of Genesis. I can kind of summarize a lot of this. It's a story of Jacob, the deceiver, who himself is tricked by Laban. He ends up with two wives. The wife that he really loves can't have children. Boy, do we see a recurring story through the family of Abraham. But the wife that he doesn't love has children. She bears sons. And so we have conflict within that family. Conflict between the wives. Conflict between the sons. More sons are born by handmaids until finally Rachel is able to bear Joseph. And guess what? Jacob was a favorite of his mother. And Jacob makes Joseph his favorite and lets it be known that he's his favorite. So we have favoritism in the family again. Sad thing to see. There's more favoritism shown. Eventually, Jacob goes back to Canaan, and his name is changed to Israel. And later on, his son Joseph is sold into slavery because of envy of his brothers. Keeps recurring, doesn't it? Envy of the brothers, so they sell him into slavery. Ephraim and Manasseh are born to him, and Jacob, or whose name was changed to Israel, Jacob says, okay, treat them like my own children. I want them to inherit like my own sons. Our booklet on the U.S., Britain, and the Commonwealth and Prophecy explains that pretty well about the switching of the hands even of Ephraim and Manasseh, so I won't go into that. Then comes the story of the captivity. They're in Egypt at this point. They're captive as slaves. God begins to free them. And guess who the first people to attack Israel when they leave Egypt are? If you guessed the family of Ishmael, you're right. Go to Exodus chapter 17. Exodus chapter 17. And as they leave Egypt, we find in verse 8. Now Amalek came and fought with Israel at Rephidim. How is Amalek related? Well, let's take a look at something else here. Let's move forward just a little bit. We have this part in place already. We have Joseph and the children of Israel and Amalek. Here is Amalek, who is a descendant, who is one of the sons of Eliphaz. So Amalek fights against Israel when they first come out of Egypt. Chapter 36, if we go to Genesis chapter 36, let's go back there, Genesis 36, we see this statement in verse 12. In Genesis 36, 12, Timnah was a concubine of Eliphaz, Esau's son, and she bore Amalek to Eliphaz. And these were the sons of Adah, Esau's wife. So Amalek is Esau's grandson, and the Amalekites were the first to attack Israel when they escaped from Egypt. More fighting within that family. Later in the period of the Judges, we find that Moab and Ammon are periodically troubling and subjugating Israel. You can go to the book of Judges and find that. They too are related to Israel. They too are related to Jacob. How does that work? All right, let's look at another slide. This is one we just looked at. Let's add Lot in here. Lot, of course, was related to Abraham. He left Padam Aram with Abraham, or Abram, as his name was at that point. And through his daughters, Moab and Ben-Ami, we find were come into play. We have Moab and Ammon, and they are fighting against Israel, the nation of Israel. Lots of conflicts up there, aren't there? It's a family that is just continually seeming to fight against itself. Family that's at war with itself. Now, as long as we're talking about trouble in the family of Abraham, it's grown immense by this point to include many nations and kingdoms. We ought to also point out that even within the family of Joseph and the descendants of his, in the nation of Israel, there was a split, wasn't there? Through the time of David, they were united as one kingdom. After David died, when Solomon was offered the chance, if you will lower the taxes, if you will treat the people with a little more compassion, they'll serve you. And instead of listening to the, Solomon's son, I'm sorry, this is after the reign of Solomon, Rehoboam promised even harsher taxation, and the people left. They formed the nation of Israel. So we have Israel and Judah. Through the family of, or through the reign or life of David and through the life of Solomon, God had them united, but eventually they split. And again, there was division with the family. And eventually, of course, both groups went into captivity. And the Jews remained visible because they kept the Sabbath. Look at, I've got a map for you just to kind of show you in those kingdom years what the world looked like. We had the nations of Moab, Ammon, and Edom all combined against, fighting against Israel. Now, during the reign of David, and particularly during the reign of Solomon, it was minor. The conflict was minor. They were not able to overcome the nation of Israel. But eventually, the nation split in two. Let me show you where those nations would be today if we transferred them to a modern map. This is a modern map, or as of 1980s. See where those names were, where those nations were. Now you have Moab, Ammon, Edom, in the area where Syria is, or Jordan is, actually. Syria is a little further north, but it is in that same general area. Okay, what does it have to do with today? Well, it explains a lot about some of the long-running feuds between the Arabs and the Jews, doesn't it? Explains a lot of that, especially when you start looking at the Jews being able to come back. I won't go through the history of Jerusalem. I think Mr. Kylo did that not too long ago here. Rather interesting history to look at. But modern problems in the area have their roots in World War I when the Turks sided with Germany. And the British promised independence to the Arab countries of Asia. The Arabs were eager to help the Allies, only to find out after the war that the British had made other conflicting promises and that they were not given a free Arab state. Instead, the British and France divided up the spoils of the Ottoman Empire into different spheres of control for themselves. In November 1917, the British announced their Balfour Declaration that pledged support for a national homeland in Palestine for the world's scattered and persecuted Jews. So here the Arabs, who had helped the Allies, thinking they would get a free country of their own, get double-crossed, and the Allies don't give it to them. Instead, they say, we're going to set up a nation for the Jews. You know, that other side of the family tree, the ones you hate so much? Those are the ones we're going to give a nation. We're going to give them this land. So you can understand in some ways why the Arabs have been so horribly upset. The Jews welcomed the Balfour Declaration. Oh, this is our chance for a nation. This is our chance for a life. But of course, the Arabs saw it as a bitter double cross. It was terrible in their eyes. And now, once peaceful neighbors, because they were able to live somewhat in harmony in the Ottoman Empire, now they become bitter enemies. And we can, again, understand a little bit more of why they became bitter enemies. Britain struggled with it till 1947. They turned it over to the United Nations, and the United Nations specifically at that point approved partitioning Palestine into two independent states, one Arab and one Jewish, with Jerusalem as under international control. The Jews loved it. The Arabs were enraged. They thought it was horrible. And they have been fighting against Israel ever since. Since 1949, Israel's borders have expanded by about 50%, despite the fact that the Arabs have over and over again tried to invade, tried to push them out into the Mediterranean, tried to destroy them. Things heat up, things cool down. There are times when of great conflict. There are times when there's a little bit more peace. What was interesting to me is to go to a website that talks about the casualties between the Jews and the Arabs over this period of conflict. And if you look at this list, this particular list came from the Jewish, it was an online library. Let's see if we can get our remote to work. There we go. Not sure if you can read the numbers from the very back. You probably read them up here in the front. But the number of dead and wounded, killed and wounded, is very, very lopsided. You look down the side for Israel, and the numbers are much smaller than they are on the side for the Arabs and Palestinians. Let me take you to the bottom of this particular same form. Here we go. When you get down to the bottom, you can see the larger numbers, probably a little bit better. 24,900 or so Jews killed compared to 91,000 Arabs killed. In fact, let me just give you the totals. I put the totals together. Those who were killed and wounded. You look at the Jewish side, 61,000. You look at the Arab side, 169,000. Interesting to note, not quite three times, certainly well more than double the number of dead and injured as a result. Incredible to see what's taken place. And the Arabs are still looking to be able to destroy Israel. I was looking at an article this week, came out this week. This is some comments from the general, the southern command for Israel. And he talked about Hamas. He said, you know, it's been a little bit mild, a little bit quiet for the last couple of years. He said, unfortunately, Hamas is using this quiet period to prepare for the next battle. So he knows what's going on. They're just waiting, biding their time, waiting for the next battle. Now, maybe that helps us understand why we are where we are. Maybe we see some of the family connections. I know it helped me to go through this some time back and put those together and see why there's so much division between the family or within the family of Abraham. What's in this message for us? Well, first of all, although Abraham taught his children about God, they were not particularly good at obeying, were they? I mean, if we go back and look at the history of Abraham's family, history is not kind to their obedience to God. Ancient Israel went into captivity. Ancient Judah went into captivity. Israel went first, and God continually preached to Judah, look, if you'll change, that won't happen to you. But if you keep on going the way you're going, disobeying me, disrespecting me, you're going to go into captivity too. Did Judah change? Nope. They were not very good at obeying God either. So they ended up going into captivity. You look at the felt jealousy, you look at the favoritism, you look at trying to buy favors by marriage, sexual immorality, all of those things are in the line of Abraham. Not all directly through Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but some of it is. It's not really very good at following God's direction in life. Secondly, of course, we realize there are great future implications. Jerusalem is destined to be in the news. Zechariah 12, if we turn there, Zechariah chapter 12. first few verses. The burden of the word of the Lord against Israel, Zechariah 12:1. Thus says the Lord, who stretches out the heavens, lays the foundations of the earth, and forms the spirit of man within him. Behold, I will make Jerusalem a cup of drunkenness to all the surrounding peoples when they lay siege against Judah and Jerusalem. And it shall happen that in that day that I will make Jerusalem a very heavy stone for all peoples. All who would heave it away will surely be cut in pieces, though all nations of the earth are gathered against it. And all the way up to the time of the end, Jerusalem is prophesied to be in the news, to be a problem to the nations around it and to those who get involved in it. It's a terrible shame that there's been so much fighting and will be so much fighting around that city and among the members of the divided family of Abraham. Daniel also prophesied that the family of Abraham would be at the midst of the events of the time of the end. To go to Daniel chapter 11. Daniel chapter 11. Daniel 11 is, we've looked at this many times, and so this is the longest running prophecy about divisions of different king of the south, king of the north. And they're going to end up right there in the Middle East, in Jerusalem, fighting. Daniel chapter 11. Verse 40, at the time of the end, the king of the south will attack him. The king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind with chariots, horsemen, and many ships. And he'll enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through. He shall also enter the glorious land, the land of Jerusalem, the land that was ancient Israel's land. He'll enter that glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape out of his hand, Moab, Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon. So they're still going to be around at the end time. Parts of the family of Abraham, when this king of the south and king of the north, divisions of the ancient Greek empire, when they come and fight over that area. He'll stretch out his hand against the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. He'll have power over the treasures of gold and silver and over all the precious things of Egypt. Also the Libyans and Ethiopians shall follow at his heels. But news from the east and the north shall trouble him. Therefore he'll go out with a great fury and destroy and annihilate. And he'll plant the tents of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain. Yet he'll come to his end and no one will help him. Well, that's a description of Jerusalem, the two seas, the Dead Sea and the Mediterranean Sea. It's going to set up his tent, his kingdom, or his tent or his mountain, his tent, his palace in that area. Ammon, Edom, Moab, and Ammon escape. And eventually in Zechariah chapter 14, if we go back to the book of Zechariah, we see at the very end time Jerusalem again in the news at Christ's return. Zechariah 14 and verse 1. Behold, the day of the Lord is coming, and your spoil will be divided in your midst, for I will gather all the nations to battle against Jerusalem. The city will be taken, the houses rifled, the women ravished, half the city will go into captivity, but the remnant of the people shall not be cut off from the city. And the Lord will go forth and fight against those nations as he fights in the day of battle. And on that day his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives, which faces Jerusalem on the east. And the Mount of Olives shall be split in two from east to west, making a very large valley. Half of the mountain will move to the north, half of it toward the south. All the way up to the return of Christ, Jerusalem is going to be in the news. It's going to be a very important part of what's taking place. In Jesus Christ, when he returns, his feet are going to stand on the Mount of Olives just east of Jerusalem. So we keep watching the Middle East. It's important for us to be aware of why those issues are going on there. And we can also, as I thought about this, we can also think a lot about relationships. We can think about family. We can think about our own relationships, our own family. Do we do all that we can to have a peaceful family? Hopefully your family's a lot more harmonious than what we looked at today. This one's pretty divided, pretty fighting against itself. Not a very good picture. No wonder God places so much emphasis on repentance, forgiveness for those he's called, on righting wrongs where we can, of trying to resolve conflicts, agreeing with an adversary, being reconciled to your brother. We're all going to have to eventually learn to get along in the family of God. I mean, ultimately, that's the goal, isn't it, for us to all be in the family of God. Now, I realize as I stand before you, I'm blessed that all my immediate family is in church and is in the same physical organization, all dedicated to try to help the same physical organization succeed. I know that's, I'm an oddball, because that's not the common thing. I realize that, and I've talked to enough people to know the difficulties and some of the pain that we have to deal with in trying to resolve things. I try to always remember, and occasionally I forget it, but most of the time I remember Romans 12:18. You cannot force someone to be at peace with you who doesn't want to be at peace with you. You simply can't do it. It's impossible. We do our part, but that's all we can do. The only way, ultimately, so think about the family of Abraham. When are they ultimately going to finally be united? When are they all finally going to be on the same page? Not going to come until after Christ's return. It's not going to come until they all seek conversion. It's not going to come until they all seek to go to Jerusalem to learn of God, to learn His way, and to begin to apply it. It's the only time it'll ever happen. It won't happen until then. It won't be until the return of Jesus Christ. But, again, we should be doing our part. As much as lies within us, as much as is possible, we need to do our part. 2 Timothy chapter 2, I think, is another passage that I would link with Romans 12:18. As much as lies within you, do your part to make peace. You can't force it, but you just do your part as much as you can do. Sometimes I think we take too much on ourselves and think, well, I have to force peace. No, you don't. You can't do that because you can't control the other person. You simply do your part, and you pray and ask God for wisdom that you do your part. And sometimes you can't resolve something. But as long as you're doing your part, that's what God is looking for. 2 Timothy chapter 2, we find a similar statement in verse 22. Paul tells this young evangelist that flee also youthful lusts, but pursue righteousness, faith, love, peace. Pursue peace. Where you can, do what you can to make peace. Pursue righteousness, pursue faith, pursue love, pursue peace. Who do you do that with? With those who call on the Lord out of a pure heart. I'll go back to the family of Abraham and say, when you look at much of what the family of Abraham did and has done through history, there's not a good track record of them seeking God out of a pure heart, is there? I don't see it, anyway. But as we find people who are seeking God out of a pure heart, those are the ones we should be pursuing peace with. Those are the ones we should work for peace with. We need to learn, as we can, much as lies within us, the way of peace, so we can be a part of that peaceful, unified family of God. One day, the entire family of Abraham and their descendants will do that too. And I'm sure Abraham is going to rejoice greatly when he sees that day. Think about it, when Abraham is resurrected and he hears about what all of his descendants did to one another. I mean, can you imagine what he's going to think? But at one point, they will have the opportunity to come together. After the meaning of these fall feasts, after the meaning of trumpets, after that's fulfilled, after Christ returns, after Satan is pulled out of the way, removed so that he can't influence mankind. Then, the saints ruling with Christ in Jerusalem, with God's law going forth, people can learn. All nations can learn the way of peace.